Large landmass dead ahead. Range, 28 miles. Impossible, responded Ensign Francis J. Flynn. I'd call myself Frank. Impossible, responded Ensign Francis J. Flynn. There's only one landmass on our heading, and that's the Dominican Republic, over 800 miles away. The radar operator adjusted and readjusted his equipment. Again, he called the officer of the watch. Ensign Flynn! Francis! The radar is showing a landmass directly ahead on our course. Take a look for yourself. Flynn studied the radar screen. You're right. It's got to be a landmass. Look how straight it is, almost as if it were drawn by a pencil. Wake up the skipper. I'm going to check the compasses and take another position fix. The sea was flat, smooth. The sky was clear. Every star and constellation that should have been visible in that area was in view. I'm reading from The Devil's Triangle 2 by Richard Weiner. The compasses were correct, and the ensign's sightings tallied with his previous fix. Still, the radar screen showed a huge landmass directly ahead on the Yamacraw's course. Steaming at 12 and a half knots, the ship had reduced the distance to 24 miles. Maintain 165 degrees, ordered the captain. Less than 2 hours later, those on the bridge were gazing ahead in awe. No more than a mile ahead, looming up out of the sea, was a large, dark mass that seemed to stretch from horizon to horizon and reach skyward as high as the men could see. The radar, which was capable of penetrating fog, showed this to be a solid mass. Minutes later, the Yamacraw was alongside the huge mass. Commander Strouch ordered his men to rig the 36-inch diameter carbon arc searchlight. As the ship moved slowly along, parallel to the mass, the men noticed that it did not come up out of the water, but rather started about a foot and a half to 2 feet above the sea's surface. Shall I read that again? You thought sure I was going to quit, so you weren't listening. Minutes later, the Yamacraw was alongside the huge mass. Commander Strouch ordered his men to rig the 36-inch diameter carbon arc searchlight. As the ship moved along parallel to the mass, the men noticed that it did not come up out of the water, but rather started about a foot and a half to 2 feet above the sea's surface. I'd get my black hull out of there. The men noticed that it did not come up out of the water, but rather started about a foot and a half to 2 feet above the sea's surface. The ship was less than 50 feet away when the big searchlight was turned on. Yet its powerful beam penetrated no more than a few feet into it. This is the U.S. Coast Guard, friends. This is not a TV evangelist ship on a miracle voyage. Gaining experiences for their next magazine. The ship was less than 50 feet away when the big searchlight was turned on, yet its powerful beam penetrated no more than a few feet into it. The radar could not penetrate the mass at all. The light disclosed the color as being a brownish gray. For half an hour, the Yamacraw steamed slowly along the edge of the mass. From time to time, the captain would order the ship to penetrate the mass for a minute or so at a time. There was no dampness or temperature change, as there would have been in the case of fog. No one was on the starboard side of the Yamacraw as it eased into the mass. Really now? Then the ship pulled several hundred yards away and continued steaming alongside the mass, which formed a straight line running northeast to southwest. Now, in case you haven't been listening, all we're doing is pointing out some strange things happen in and around the Bermuda Triangle. Am I boring you? You don't believe this story. You really don't, some of you. Any of you been sailors? This is not one guy in a rowboat. You don't really, anybody in here been sailors? You don't really think that a Coast Guard ship full of crewmen would not have one guy that would say it never happened? Those independent guys, with such a report being filed, one of them would say they had too much grog. It's just unbelievable. That, I agree. I find this very hard to believe. In fact, if one guy in a rowboat had told me the story, I'd say he was out in the sun too long. This is U.S. Coast Guard. This is searchlight. Come on now. Searchlight, radar, combined crew. That has to be the biggest and strangest UFO ever reported. Because it was a foot and a half to 2 feet above the sea surface. Now remember that other pilot? What he saw, just the top was parting the surface. Remember Dr. Brown? He was under the surface. Now, this could be penetrated. The other thing had openings. Hark back to your physics studies, folks. You have been able to mentally adjust to the fact that in spite of your pretty face and marvelous form, you are mainly hot air. Space warmed by friction of constant moving objects. That if you could gain the perspective I'm going to make up a word of a proper atomic particle telescope to where you could see from the standpoint that atoms and their constituents could be isolated, and your relative perspective was such that an atom looked as big to you as an elephant looks to us. You have adjusted your mind. You see, you can see abstractly that we're more space than solid matter and capable of being penetrated. You have abstractly adjusted your mind that you can't really tell where you begin and where you end. Can anybody tell you exactly where your atoms quit revolving and somebody else's or something else starts? It's relative. It's what makes the philosophers go into their mental seances and argue. And I told you this before, the whole world is divided into two philosophic camps based upon their epistemological viewpoint. Epistemology is theory of knowledge, what can be known and what's knowable. There are only two alternates, and everything else is a part of one or the other. You will either be an idealist in epistemology, and that has nothing to do with the emotional meaning of an idealist. I'm using it strictly in the realm of philosophy, theory of knowledge, epistemology. An idealist believes that things consist in and of relationships, and all that is are relationships. A realist believes that there are entities that exist and they have relationships between one another and are essentially unchanged thereby. Anybody in the right mind knows the realist view is the accurate one. Because from your earliest youth, you were captured. I've covered this before, but maybe I can throw it in here. From your earliest youth, our thought patterns were formed by the language frame we were born in. The English language is essentially predetermined to the realist perceptual set. Our verbs change and our nouns do not. I ran home, I will run home, I am running home, I have run home. The verb form changes. But I and home remain unchanged. That's the way our thought structure developed. That's why it's so ludicrous to talk about not having faith. You can't exist without faith. The issue is whether your faith target is a solid ground or false. God dignifies faith and only will call it faith if you hang your action on His permanence. Anything else is called this faith. But all of life is faith. The way you view life, you didn't think it through. Frame of reference is what you take for granted as being true without proving it. The difference between an ignorant man and a learned man is a learned man, he's dominated by a frame of reference, but he knows what it is. Most people are controlled with their frame of reference and don't know it. We view reality a certain way. It doesn't make it right. Our language coerced our thought patterns. And we view reality as having fixed entities connected by relationships. And it's next to impossible to make a Western brain think otherwise. That's why they take Eastern religious thought and graft it onto the Western brain and abort it. Idealists, of which far more of the world's population are gripped in a language frame differently, say nothing exists but relationships. And the philosophers ask stupid questions like, can a noise be heard in the woods when there's nobody there to hear it? Stupid. Anybody knows. Sure, the noise is there. Now, I've done this before. Describe that camera to me. Anybody want to describe that camera to me? You can talk now. What is that camera? It's gray. Well, what's gray? Gray is a relationship. That's a relationship. Color is a relationship. There's no such thing as gray floating around in the space and time. Gray is a relationship. It's the way you view it. What else? Tell me more about the camera. Huh? Metal. That's an abstract description for a mineral combination alloy that has certain traits. You're telling me a relationship that we have reduced down to an abstract summary word. What's metal? I mean, when you just added a synonym. You got to describe what metal is. What's metal? Tell me, what is that Peter's standing alongside? We call a camera that's been reduced down in one of its attributes called metal. Well, now, you say it's a construct, that's the word you use? It's a construct of molecules. What's a molecule? Molecule is but a way of describing something that we have identified by extending our relationships through scientific instruments. We get down to what's a molecule. Huh? Still in here. Charged particles. You've used two words. Particles, which describes a space limitation, which is a relationship, and charged, which describes another kind of relationship we have. You haven't told me anything that isn't a relationship. Well, it's square and round. It's a relationship. Well, it's heavy. Weighs so much. That's a relationship. You cannot. I'm telling you, it's rhetorical. That's why I don't have any trouble asking this question. There's nothing you can tell me about that that is not a description or an abstract identifying of a relationship. You haven't found anything other than relationships I'm having with that. What's that? You take as one answer, you break it down into smaller particles by extending our sensory apparatus through scientific instruments. You just have extended the field of relationships. You're still chasing something elusive that can only be described in terms of a relationship we have with it. Now, I'm telling you, going out the gate, there is no way you can find or say anything about whatever that is not a relationship you're having with it. You say it's small, well, small to you. It's not very small, that camera, to the smallest particle therein. Pretty big, in fact. I mean, to the smallest particle therein, that camera looks like the Milky Way looks to those of us on Earth. It's a relationship you have with it. Now, I don't expect this to produce any emotive feel, because we simply do not have the language frame to enable us to conceptualize it, to gestalt it, without coming at it again and again. I'm not sure I can do it. We'll spend my whole life at it. A variety of things, not only the least, but very much a part of your conclusion is the frame you've grown up in. Our language frame conditions the way we look at reality. And any person brought up in the English language knows, I don't care, you can use that rhetoric with me all you want, there's something there and I'm here and we're having relationships and I can't fuck with it. It's there. Any dumb jackass knows it's there. You don't have relationships with relationships. Well, yes, you do. My professor, who happened to be an idealist, used to say to me, fly over the ocean and tell me where one wave ends and the other one begins. Well, you can't really say where one starts and the other begins, but you can get a feel that that wave's not the same as that wave. There are two waves there. Now make it tough. Where does the wave end and the ocean begin? And what you have is a foci of relationships, he says. And it's easier to distinguish between the foci of relationships than it is the relationship and the reality of the sea. Well, that's philosophers. You know, they're all nuts. Richard Dettering, who was doing his doctorate at Stanford same time I was doing it, and I use this as probably the best illustration, did his doctorate on an Indian tribe that had a language frame. Every time the verb changed, the noun changed. If the verb form changed, the noun changed. They had a fluid language, and their conception of reality was different. They grew up recognizing in their conceptual frame, you change the relationship, the entity changes. The Mauni in India believes original sin was language, where items begin to be differentiated from one another. And they take a vow of silence, they stare at the sun till they go blind, they go into caves and live in darkness, they stand on their head and look at the horizon in odd directions until they gain an ability to see an undifferentiated mass of color, thereby freeing themselves from the consequence of original sin. Now, I'm not recommending any of this. I'm just saying that if you and I were born in a more fluid language frame, our emotion and temperament would make the idealist view more congenial. Most of the Eastern world views our differentiated reality as appearance and the cause of man's problem and the illusion that keeps him in the wheel of life, and their salvation experience is a trance-like state that delivers you from the ongoing wheel of life. And they won't even define reality. They call it the that which is behind all that. Undifferentiated nothingness. And the goal of salvation is to escape from any identity with this world and its individuality and its differentiation. Now, the relevance I'll come back to. I'm glad that I find it easy to identify with what God chose as the language frame of revelation. In the fullness of time, God sent His Son. And if I were mentally congenial to the idealist frame, the authority of Christ would move me into the realist frame. But I accept the realist frame not because my language is congenial to it. I'm thankful it is. All the more proof that we are in the domain of the kingdom people, in the election of race. Because God sent His Son and chose to reveal the fullest revelation, where the language frame was the Greek language, which coerces you into the realist view of reality. But the idealist view of reality is all that exists are relationships. You see, you can't prove it either way. It's a faith leap. You simply cannot describe anything in this world other than describing relationships. The idealist says, since I can't find anything but relationships, therefore nothing exists except relationships. And I'm a part of the relationship, and it's a part of me. It leads to pantheism. It makes prayer an inward look. It stops the dialogue. God, instead of being the great other, we're a part of God. He's a part of us. You find God within yourself by losing consciousness. And ultimate reality is to be merged with the stream of ultimate consciousness, which is nothingness. It affects your view of reality. It affects your view of prayer. There is no immortality of the soul. There is no individuality. It lends itself to the communist dialectic, where being part of the force, your immortality is the contribution you make to the ongoing stream. It affects your value judgment. It affects truth. And the average man on the street doesn't know anything about this. But whether he does or doesn't change the reality. That the philosophies of communism, the philosophies of the Eastern religions, all come out of the idealist frame. The realist frame says, I may not be able to locate it. But somewhere, if I could extend my sensory apparatus far enough, or if I had a dimension of seeing, there is something. I can't define it. I can only define relationships I have. But there's something, and I'm someone, and the relationships connect us, but the relationships are separate and distinct from the relator. From that philosophy, you get individual immortality. From that philosophy, you get the dignity of individuality. From that philosophy, you get the reality of freedom's ability to affect his relationships. From that relationship and that idea of philosophy, you get the concept of prayer in the Christian frame, which is a dialogue with the great other. You get the I-Thou relationship of Martin Buber in the Jewish frame, Reinhold Niebuhr, who picked up on it himself in the dramas of history, in the Christian frame. Why am I philosophizing? Why don't we go back to dumping on people for sinning? And make God small and pea-brained. I am glad that I'm in a language frame that lends itself to the realist view. I find it easy to view reality from the realist frame, that relationships are had between pre-existing entities. But had I been born in another frame, the authority of God's choice of the Grecian frame and the fullness of time, the situation into which Christ came, and the language that God talked to us in the revelatory pattern, which was his choice of timing, would make me a realist. But I have enough philosophy training to respect and see the consequences of the alternative frame, and why there's no fixed values, no fixed morality. And what most people do not understand is that John Dewey, who pioneered and fathered progressive education, philosophically called experimentalism, that produced the warped and inadequate value frame of this generation. Progressive education was fathered by John Dewey, and John Dewey was an explicit, fully understanding, and totally committed idealist. His epistemology, from which his philosophy of education flowed, was idealism. And most of the theological concepts taught in most biblical seminaries come out of the German idealism of the 19th century, which is wholly and totally alien. I'm sorry to say, one of my favorite writers, when he got on epistemology, was an idealist, C.S. Lewis. And you will find it when he stretches his philosophic views to the maximum concepts of individuality and eternity. But when he stays on historical subjects such as the nature of Christ, or when he stays in his gifted realm of writing the parables of the Pilgrim's Regress and other such things, he's without a peer. But he too was in the clutch of the theological mindset. German idealism dominated theology, and it dominates the seminaries today, some of whom think I'm heretical. I went through master's training in college before I ever took a course in philosophies of education. I had to get to Stanford at the doctoral level to find out the philosophic foundations of progressive education. But that comes back to this mass. Even with the philosophic options there and my commitment for biblical reasons to the realist view, so you can all relax. You didn't have to think it through. You're lucky enough to be born in a language frame that makes you a realist without trying. That's the biblical frame, so you're lucky. But even in the realist frame, We don't have the ability yet to understand this molecular arrangement. Now, we don't mind looking at Star Trek and seeing these old boys get on that little old round thing and fuzz away on the ship and unfuzz wherever it was they were headed. We know a little bit about molecular displacement. We become scientific. We can split an atom and get an explosion. We produce so much energy thereby. We mutate reality around it. Literally destroy relationships, create new ones in a harmful, mutative way that could destroy, through the energy produced, mankind and his environment. God, for a long time, has known how to pull it apart and put it together and hold it together and reassemble it. You suppose anybody else knows? The men noticed it did not come up the mass, that is, out of the water, but rather started about a foot and a half to 2 feet above the sea surface. The ship was less than 50 feet away. Let's get back to the Bermuda Triangle. I'm tired of philosophizing. I mean, you know, if I don't stay at least somewhat intelligible to mediocre minds, TV evangelists will not have anything they will know enough to criticize next week. I mean, the last 30 minutes was understood by most of you, but my critics are trying to figure out how they can preach against that. He criticized idealism. I heard it with my own ears. He criticized the blessed faith of the Father's idealism. Now I've given them their answer. Let's go on. The ship was less than 50 feet away with the big searchlight turned on, yet its powerful beam penetrated no more than a few feet into it. The radar couldn't penetrate the mass at all. The light disclosed the color as being a brownish gray. For half an hour, the Yamacross steamed slowly along the edge of the mass. From time to time, the captain would order the ship to penetrate it for a minute or so at a time. There was no dampness or temperature change as there would have been in the case of fog. No one was on the starboard side of the Yamacross at eased into the mass. Then the ship pulled several hundred yards away and continued steaming alongside the mass, which formed a straight line running northeast to southwest. After a few minutes, Commander Strouch ordered the helm eased over to the starboard and the USCGC Yamacross slowly eased back into the strange brownish gray mass that was impenetrable by either searchlight or radar. The high intensity carbon arc lamp, 3 feet across, that's a big lamp. Ain't no pocket flash. The high intensity carbon arc lamp became only a dull glow, and then only when one looked directly at it. And as before, there was no change in temperature or humidity. On the deck, visibility was absolute zero. Some of the men groping their way around the Yamacross deck commented that the substance into which they had steamed felt like suspended particles of fine sand or dust. Yet, there was no movement of the mass, as there would have been had it been one of those rare dust storms at sea. The air was dead still. The ship moved forward with just enough way to maintain steerage. The radar screen showed only a green clutter. The ship's compasses still worked. Suddenly, there was a spontaneous... Now let's go... Let's go to this one now. Am I boring you? You reckon anybody's out there? I ain't gonna go any... Well, wait a minute. Got some more interesting stuff here if you're interested. Suddenly, there was spontaneous. Suddenly, there was spontaneous. We'll leave that right there. And we'll go back to here. Leave the mass and go to here. We will forever leave the mass and never go to here. Whatever here is. If I don't get some calls. I mean, I'd hate to think that a little philosophizing on Sunday afternoon would turn my audience off. Got to have some calls now. 1-800-338-3030. Unless I get some calls, unless I get some indication that people understand that you can be a great help by being in the King's House next Sunday and you're going to try. I want to know how many people are sending anything in for September, and I want everybody who loves me to tell me. I just thrive on that. Some of you went out and bought this book, didn't you? It is the best summary. Now, he didn't draw any conclusions. He just presents the evidence for the question that demands an answer. But it is probably the best. You know, some scientists can't write very well, and Berlitz, give him credit, is a pretty good communicator. It's well written. Atlantis, the Eighth Continent, by Charles Berlitz. We've ordered a large supply for our bookstore. They're $16.95, I'm told. What's it take to ship them? About $1.50. $19 would cover it all. You can get them usually in your own bookstores, but if you can't, they'll take orders here for Dolores Press. Atlantis, the Eighth Continent, Charles Berlitz, $19 would cover shipping and everything, wouldn't it? Okay. Probably the best summary around. Now this, we were reading all last week, a couple of nights. The funniest one was Ed Wilson, the mayoral candidate of Orlando, Florida, piling an open Waco with a Continental engine equipped for 12-hour flights. He sees something raising out of the water. And Dr. Brown... No, Harry Marshall, the Greek industrialist, conducted an expedition taking closed-circuit television footage of a pyramidal mound off of Kaysaw Bank at a depth of over 750 feet. They were right over the pyramid, he says. Top seemed to be about 150 feet from the surface. Total depth about 650 feet. Now, the pyramid in Egypt's 5,449 pyramid inches, isn't it? You divide that by 12, you get how many feet? Somewhere between 400 and 500 feet. This one's 650 feet. Is that the way you'd calculate? Remember those 12 pyramids? Spotted the Land's at too, in the Amazon jungles of Peru. Still haven't figured them out yet. 12 of them, two side by side. Just a little shorter than, just showed up as 8 dots first on Land's at too from 500 miles up. Who built all these? And then Dr. Brown, he was swimming. As we swam on, I like to read this one. That just gives me the chills. As we swam on, the water became clearer. I was close to the bottom at 135 feet and was trying to keep up with a diver ahead of me. I turned to look toward the sun through the murky water and saw a pyramid shape shining like a mirror. About 35 to 40 feet from the top was an opening. I remember Ari Marshall saw an opening too. We lowered the camera and high-intensity lights down the side of the mast back to Marshall. Suddenly came to an opening. Light flashes or shining white objects were being swept into the opening by turbulence. Further down, same thing happened in reverse. They were coming out. Now, Dr. Brown, I looked toward the sun through the murky water and saw a pyramid shape shining like a mirror. I just love to drag this out. About 35 to 40 feet from the top was an opening. I was reluctant to go inside. Big black hole. But I swam in anyway. The opening was like a shaft debouching into an inner room. I saw something shining. It was a crystal held by two metallic hands. I had on my gloves and I tried to loosen it. It became loose. As soon as I grabbed it, I felt this was the time to get out and not come back. I'm not the only person who has seen these ruins. Others have seen them from the air, and they say they're 5 miles wide and more than that in length. There's a lot going on in this area. Now, you know that in Revelation 20, well, let's go back to Revelation 9. The fifth angel sounded, "We're in the great tribulation." And I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth. And the key was given him, for to him was given the key of the bottomless pit. Circle those words, the bottomless pit. And he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit as the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. And there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth. And unto them was given power as the scorpions of the earth have power. These are not helicopters, friends. These are demons. They came out of the bottomless pit. You'll find in your margin a reference to Luke 8. Go to Luke 8. Jesus is going to have some demons talk to him. 8:17, isn't it? 8:31. It's the scene of the demoniac of the Gadarenes. Verse 26, Jesus' party arrived at the country of the Gadarenes, which is over against Galilee. And when he went forth to land, there met him out of the city a certain man which had devils. Now, the Greek word for devil is diablo. The Greek word for demons is daimons. The Greek word being translated devils here is daimons. It's only one devil, there's several demons. It's just simply wrong. The King James people put devils down, but the Greek word daimons, which had demons long time and wear no clothes, neither abode in any house but in the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell down before him, and with a loud voice says, "What are we to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of God Most High? I beseech thee, torment me not." For he had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man. For oftentimes it had caught him, and he was kept bound with chains and in fetters, and he brake the bands and was driven to the devil into the wilderness. Jesus asked him, saying, "What is thy name?" Now this is gospel. This is New Testament. Intelligent Christianity. Most people don't read it. Jesus asked him, saying, "What is thy name?" He said, "Legion." The demons in him possessed his tongue. And the demons were doing the speaking. Legion, because many devils were entered into him. Again, it's demons. And they, the demons, besought him that he would not command them to go into the deep. There it's translated deep. Revelation 11 was translated bottomless pit. You go to your margin, you'll find that it refers you to Revelation 20, right? Verse 3. Let's go back to Revelation. After Armageddon, 20th chapter opens, I saw an angel come down from heaven having the key of the bottomless pit. There it is again, bottomless pit. And a great chain in his hand. He laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years and cast him into the bottomless pit. There it's called bottomless pit. There's only one word in the Greek, in both cases, all the cases. Now these demons back in Luke 8:31 besought Jesus that he would not command them to go into the bottomless pit. Same word in the Greek. There's no suggestion at all in the Greek that it's bottomless. None whatever. All the word is in the Greek is abyss, which is a direct cognate. We got that word in English. I don't know why they didn't translate it. They besought him that he would not command them to go into the abyss. Satan's bound 1,000 years in the abyss. The scorpion demons are released with the smoke from the abyss. Now, where is this abyss? Out there in the sky? There's 200 million demons bound near the river Euphrates. That's separate from the abyss. How many are in the abyss? Only God knows. Satan will go in the abyss. Jesus had the power to simply command. To the abyss they went. On one place, demons come up and ask him, is he going to send them to the abyss before their time? There are demons all over the place. Let's just go to the short gospel, Mark. They went to Capernaum, 21st verse, first chapter. They went to Capernaum. Just start circling the number of demons running around where you find them. Now, that demon was talking to them okay there in Capernaum. Jesus recognized who the real spokes personages were. They went into Capernaum straightway on the Sabbath day. Jesus, he entered into the synagogue and taught. They were astonished at his doctrine, for he taught them as one that had authority and not as the scribes. And there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit. And he cried out, saying, let us alone. What have we to do with thee, thou Jesus of Nazareth? Art thou come to destroy us? I know thee, who thou art, the Holy One of God. Well, let's see if we can find the reference over in Luke. Luke 4. That's the one. You need to learn to use your Bible. Good illustration. See, in the 23rd verse, there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit. You go to T in the margin if you got a Bible like mine. It says Luke 4:33. What's... Yeah, here it is. Same thing is told in Luke, beginning of 31st verse, 4th chapter. Came to Capernaum, a city of Galilee, and taught them on the Sabbath day. They were astonished at his doctrine, for his word was with power. And in the synagogue there was a man which had a spirit of an unclean devil. Now that again is the word daemon. And cried out with a loud voice, saying, let us alone. What have we to do with thee? Notice we. For what have we to do with thee, thou Jesus of Nazareth? Now, Jesus tells one occasion, his word is clear. When you're delivered from a demon, you entertain its entrance again. He'd go out and find seven more worse than himself and bring them back. And more than one can camp out. Let us alone. What have we to do with thee, Jesus of Nazareth? Art thou come to destroy us? I know thee who thou art, the Holy One of God. Let's go back to Mark. Jesus rebuked him, saying, hold thy peace and come out of him. Let's go see what Matthew has to say about it. Well, you know, all three of these reporters felt it was important enough to talk about. He just talks to Matthew about him being teaching full of authority. But you'll find that in the 28th verse, 8th chapter, when he was come to the other side of the country of the Gergesenes, that's the Gadarenes also, another cognate, there met him two possessed with devils, coming out of the tombs exceeding fierce, so that no man might pass that way. Behold, they cried out, saying, what have we to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of God? Art thou come hither to torment us before the time? They know that their time is run. And they won't last forever. Let's go back and find some more devils. Back to Mark 1. Jesus rebuked him, said, hold thy peace, come out of him. And when the unclean spirit had torn him and cried with a loud voice, he came out of him. 26th verse, Mark 1. And they were all amazed insomuch that they questioned among themselves, saying, what thing is this? 34th verse, he healed many that were sick of divers diseases and cast out many devils. Demons it is again. and suffered not the demons to speak, for they knew him. How'd they know him? How'd they know him? You see, they were around before the fall when Satan was the crowning cherub on the mountain of God. They had been in heaven through many ages past. And when Satan was cast down, some demons were bound, 200 million of them, chained with the river Euphrates. Some were put in the abyss. Some were left to run around and do Satan's bidding as the prince of the power of the air. And he has princes that rule in this world and influence the happenings of time. That's why Paul says, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers and things evil. High places, wickedness in high places, wicked ones, literally. Sometimes people say, why is it that what you're doing, which is so right, doesn't move into these cities and instantly have no problems and just success? Prince of the power of the air in the cities I go in knows that his foundations are going to be shaken. He knows that his hold on that town is not going to be the same. He doesn't care that preachers come in and rap you on the head and try to make you self-righteous. He doesn't care if all this silliness that's a shame of God and on God comes into town. It's only when you come in developing faith, doing it God's way, and challenge the very foundations of Satan that you've got a war on your hands. These devil, demons are real. He suffered not the demons to speak because they knew him. He wasn't yet ready to be revealed for who he was. 39th verse. He preached in the synagogues throughout all Galilee and cast out devils, literally demons. And that's one little old territory. How many think of running loose in Los Angeles? There's something getting my dogs every Sunday morning. I've learned to protect myself against my dogs on Sunday morning so they can't be used to disrupt. You don't believe that, do you? I'm at war every moment with Satan. He knows it. You ought to be. En route to the next little demon encounter, people are criticizing him about his teaching. He says, no man putteth new wine into old bottles, lest the new wine doth burst the bottles, and the wine is spilled, and the bottles will be marred. But new wine must be put into new bottles. Now, of course, when Jesus talks of wine, it's unfermented, non-alcoholic. How did Jesus know this about wine? If he didn't encounter the real stuff once in a while. I just threw that in. You know, he could have picked, don't you think he could have picked a better illustration of the gospel? I mean, he picked some sort of suggestively sinful analogies. Why bring up this subject if he doesn't want man to ever taste wine? Why did Jesus do that to us?